Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the International Biodynamic Guild podcast. I'm your host, Will Bratton, and today we're joined by Dr. Carly Newday. Carly is a water researcher whose primary work focuses on the science of structured water. She is the author of Water Codes, which examines the dynamic physics of water, its role in the body, and our spiritual relationship with water throughout antiquity. She is also senior research director at Water Inc. You can find her work and book at watercodes.com. And I'd just like to start by saying that your book, Water Codes, has been my absolute favorite book on this subject since it was published in 2014, because it combines all my other favorites on the subject, like Dr. Gerald Pollack, you know, concepts that Maewon Ho presents, etc. And it brings them all together in this grand narrative, a real gestalt. So just thank you so much for joining us. How and when did you find this subject, water?
It's maybe 2010, 2011, that I really started diving in deep. You know, water has been a center point of my life since I was a kid. I was a competitive swimmer. I grew up in lake country. I was just kind of surrounded by water my whole life. And eventually found myself looking up energy and trying to find sort of what's underneath the superficial physical experience, and found myself again brought towards water as sort of that bridge between the physical and energetic world.
And so I'd like to get into some of the different ways that one might influence water, and start with some that we're particularly familiar with in biodynamics. How does vortexing impact water?
Right. So water is extremely responsive to all kinds of stimuli in order to restructure and rearrange itself. And what it's doing when it's structuring and arranging itself is it's encoding itself with information. So vortexing, for example, is one way that water accumulates energy and stores that energy and information into its pattern. So when you look at the way that water moves in nature, it's going through rapids, it's twisting and turning in that sensitive chaos of movement. And all of that movement and twisting really imparts energy and information to the water. It's picking up, it's interacting with itself, each other, and its environment. And it's increasing its structural interface activity through that movement. So vortexing is one way, it's just one, that we can impact the arrangement of molecules within the water, which of course has a huge impact on its properties and how water reacts in its world and how well it's able to support life.
And do you think there's any impact from human contact, like using one's arm to perform the vortexing, for example?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Water is incredibly sensitive. So there's really no limit to how we can interact with and affect the structure of water. And from various researchers around the world, the general consensus seems to be that water is most sensitive to consciousness. So when you talk about using your arm to vortex water, you're now really involving yourself in that process. And just like in quantum physics, you know, a lot of the power is in the observer. It's the same thing with water in terms of using your consciousness to really interact and affect. That's a powerful, powerful tool, which water is incredibly responsive to. So we really are mostly created from water. 99% of our molecules by count, not weight, is structured water. There is virtually no water in the body that is unstructured, at least not within the cells, that is unstructured, except in aging or diseased and unhealthy cells. So we really are just structured water beings. And using that resonance, you know, it's communicating in the same language. I really do feel that that's why consciousness is one of the most powerful tools to impact the structure of water. Is because we speak in that same language. We carry a resonance because we're water beings. So yeah, the more we can involve positive human consciousness and positive human intention in structuring our water, the more effective it will be. Of course, there's bounds to that, right? You don't want to be vortexing your water when you're extremely upset and in this negative space. And of course, there's considerations to be had for the effect that subconscious negativity can have when we're interacting in that way. So intention really matters. Mindfulness really matters. And yeah, absolutely. Human interaction, that consciousness is super important.
And what are the impacts of adding various substances to water, such as, say, quartz crystal?
Yeah, absolutely. Crystals in particular have a really great relationship with water, especially quartz. They share a similar hexagonal structure. So again, we're talking about better resonance in terms of speaking in the same language, being able to transfer information without loss in translation or with less loss of information transfer. So quartz is a wonderful tool to use. Adding minerals and crystals to water really improves its ability to structure. A water that is devoid of minerals, so just absolutely, completely pure, is not well structured. It really requires, water requires these very trace amounts of minerals in order to arrange itself around. They use it as building blocks in their lattices. So that matters. Minerals definitely, trace elements are important. It's very hard to find water on the planet that doesn't have some sort of trace mineral to it. And that's a primary reason. At least, let me rephrase that. It's hard to find a usable source of water on the planet that supports life that doesn't have some sort of trace mineral in it. And that's why, you know, the water really requires that to mature itself and to structure itself around as building blocks. Quartz crystal, in particular, like I said, is important because of that resonance. But also quartz has this wonderful ability to store information. We see that in quartz hard drives. It also has a wonderful property of being able to resonate and amplify frequencies. We see that in quartz radios, for example, and transmit energy. So quartz is a wonderful tool to use. Something to remember about quartz, especially as we start getting into that realm of information storage, which, you know, applies both in a technology world of hard drives and in that metaphysical world of energy and conscious information. Quartz is an indiscriminate storage and amplifier. So it's going to store energy regardless of whether it's a positive intention or it's the chaos of the computer lab and, you know, just a jarbling of destructive electromagnetic frequencies. It's going to store information regardless, whether it's life supportive or harmful and entropic. So that's just something to, again, be mindful of. It's important, very important, I feel, that we respect and stay mindful of our tools. And I'm sure you see that a lot in biodynamic farming and the importance of being a mindful participant in that practice.
And so I'd like to get back to some of the potential applications of biodynamics, but I'm also familiar with your work in continuing the discoveries of Dr. Marcel Vogel. And you were just discussing, you know, the impact of human consciousness on crystal. Could you tell us who Dr. Marcel Vogel is and some of his discoveries and inventions and some of the things you've done to continue his work?
Sure. Yeah. That background's really interesting. You know, Marcel was my real entry point into the world of liquid crystal water and structured water. I originally came across Marcel when I was looking up EMF protections and sort of the science behind why certain things were helpful for EMF sensitivity, which I struggle with since a carbon monoxide poisoning when I was younger. So when I came across Marcel, Marcel was an IBM researcher for 27 years. He participated in developing the original magnetic hard drives. Earlier in his career, he had developed a lot of phosphorescent materials, phosphorescent paints, sort of the father of our glow-in-the-dark world today, of glow-in-the-dark phosphorescent toys and tools. So, you know, Marcel was a prominent laboratory scientist and crystallographer. And he left IDM to further study the relationship between quartz and consciousness that he had observed working in the lab at IBM. So he went on to develop a specific shape of quartz that would act similar to the way that a ruby acts with light. So a ruby, our original lasers are made from rubies. The structure, the way that the molecules arrange themselves in a ruby allows for a properly cut ruby to cohere and transmit light. That's how we're able to take incoherent light and cohere it into a laser beam. And so he discovered a very similar shape for quartz crystal that could be used for consciousness, the energy and information that is yet unseen. So he created this crystal and he tested it in various ways. He studied the effect that it had on water and how it would affect the structure of water, and really birthed a lot of the science relating structured water back to crystallographic properties. There's been a lot of researchers that have been prominent water scientists. Victor Schauberger is often thought of as sort of the father of structured water. I tend to see Marcel as that role for me, simply due to the crystallographic science approach that he took to it, which is what I really resonated with, coming from a world where I studied the properties of crystals and how they affected energy and health. So, you know, Marcel described the crystallographic properties of structured water, the different crystallographic patterns that it carried, and he linked that through quartz and consciousness to sort of examine this really cooperative relationship. In this real biofeedback relationship, where consciousness is affecting the structure of the water, which is a liquid crystal, very similar to quartz in its relationship with energy information, which then goes back to feed the state of the consciousness, impacting the structure of the water and its liquid crystal properties. So it really opened my eyes to that world of the biofeedback. I think I had always been sort of looking to understand the connection between the physical world and the energetic world, and understanding that mind-body-spirit connection, and that is so vital to our experience, and is not metaphysical at all. This is very accepted that, you know, we have a mind-body-spirit relationship where these all play a role, and I really wanted to get to the mechanism and understandings of that. And Marcel was the way in for me, where I could start to really see the way that these patterns were affecting each other and how that affected energy and information, from how well our DNA is able to transmit information and the structure of our cells, how well they're able to maintain health, to our consciousness, our state of mind, and ultimately our experience.
Awesome. I've built some water devices, and I would take the Vogel crystal and mount it in a quartz sleeve at the point of the collapse of the vortex. The water would be vortexing, and then I'd also use different color bands of light and different far infrared emitters, toroidal magnetic coils, shungite structuring devices, all in the same device. And I'd like to get into each of those kind of concepts with you. Of the things I just listed off, is there anywhere you'd like to start? Color, far infrared light, magnetism?
You know, we can cover any of all of that. Part of my work previously was developing light therapy systems that worked with bioavailable frequency spectrum colors of light, worked with magnetically induced Vogel crystals that were filled with specific gems and minerals to impart that crystallography to the water. And so I really resonate with everything you just said there. We can jump in wherever you'd like.
Let's start with far infrared, Dr. Pollack's work, what that means for, you know, liquid crystal and lattices and sheets, and then we can build the book with those sheets.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, again, water is super responsive to energy and stimuli. And so far infrared is one of the ways that we're able to affect water and impart structure to it and really designate layers and stacks of water. Stacking water is really important. When water stacks, it nests within itself. It creates these really complex organizational patterns. And that stacking, when we look at, say, the telomeres on the end of our DNA, we see that that stacking is really, really what protects those telomeres from decaying and the loss of stacking. So when we talk about sheets, I tend to think of it as stacking. I assume that's where you're going with that. And so far infrared, one of the reasons that it's been very effective in a lot of therapeutic settings is because of the structure that it has on the water we use. Pollack's work, Pollack describes a fourth phase of water, which Marcel termed a liquid crystal mesophase. It's really that liquid crystal phase we're talking about is in between the solid structure of water as ice and the liquid structure we think of as bulk water without arrangement. It's really not a lot of bulk water in nature. There's virtually none in any healthy biological systems. And so the water that we primarily really are interacting with in our world is that fourth phase of water that Pollack talks about. Another thing that Pollack goes over is when water's recombining and restructuring itself, which he tends to really examine closely as it hits the surface of different tools and materials that he's using. He's able to look at that exclusion zone, and then he's able to monitor sort of these different levels of hydrogen and oxygen relationships. So what we consider generally as H2O might show up as H4O. Water is really more of a forever updated network of information. You know, you can evaluate water, look at its structure and arrangement, and have a picture of the energy that it is exposed to at that present time. And it updates itself every like quadrillionth of a second. Water is continuously rearranging itself in self-similar patterns to update itself to the current information. So when we expose it to things like colored light or far infrared or even just these other structure and energies from other various materials, the hydrogen and oxygen bonds are rearranging themselves and recombining in different structures of organization and patterns. And so what we're taught as just a simple blanket H2O, you know, when it's really scrutinized, it's not just an H2O. We have various combinations and patterns of hydrogen and oxygen arrangements, such as H3O2 and H4O and various combinations. And one of the things I've really appreciated Dr. Pollack bringing up is that it is not a simple static dihydrogen monoxide sort of structure.
And so further along this idea of how light impacts water, I know there's some research around the different color bands. I think it's approximately 612 nanometer amber, increasing seed germination and mosquito larval hatching, and 432 nanometer, deep indigo, increasing conductivity, for example. And whenever I cast those band widths on the water, I feel like it's mimicking something like with the 612 amber, like a sunrise or sunset, or with the 432 deep indigo, maybe like a moonlight. What are your thoughts on color, and then further sunlight, moonlight, starlight, our natural lights?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with everything you just said. I mean, really what we're doing is we're targeting certain aspects of nature. These spectrums exist in nature. They exist more strongly at certain times than others. For example, you mentioned sunrise and twilight for, you know, amber versus indigo. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're using a natural phenomenon in nature and their effects on life, and specifically, really, its effects on biowater. That's how we're impacting life, is we're affecting its water. And we're maximizing those to increase efficiency for things like seed germinations, root elongations, preventing bacteria growth, that kind of thing, especially when we're talking about plants, right? And really, when we want to evaluate the effect that biowater has on living systems, plants are a fantastic way for us to do that. So certainly we can see that if something is increasing the vitality and health and growth, pest resistance, disease resistance, drought resistance in plants, we can certainly understand how that could impact our physical bodies and our greater environments and ecological systems as a whole. There's been a lot of research done on the effect that different colored light has on health. And I just think it's important for us to remember that the way it affects health or plants is through its action on our water. That is what determines how our systems function, what processes are accelerated or suppressed, and really sort of how life proceeds. It's all about the structure of our water and the information contained. So those sorts of experiments, super easy to do, really wonderful to implement. And as you've noticed, make a serious difference.
So getting back to kind of the biodynamic implications. We were talking about quartz, and I'm sure you're aware of biodynamic 501, where we crush the quartz and fill the cow horn and bury it and whatnot, and then take it into a foliar spray or other applications. Are there any other crystals you might recommend for something like that? Tourmaline, amethyst, anything?
Yeah, absolutely. So amethyst and tourmaline are both very closely related to quartz. These are wonderful things to add in. I do find that quartz is nature's powerhouse. There's a reason that people tend to gravitate towards using quartz above other elements. And it is such a remarkable storehouse of information, amplifier of information, transmitter of information. That's why we use it for so many different things, from radios to watches to tuning forks, you name it. So tourmaline, you mentioned, a wonderful thing to also include. Tourmaline has especially black tourmaline, has incredible static charge that allows it to grab information. It's sort of how it's able to grow. It kind of grab ionized information and uses that to pull itself upward. So tourmaline is a fantastic thing to add. Amethyst is a wonderful thing to add. Amethyst has a mineral content that is really resonant with healing and growth. There's shungite, a fabulous thing to include. Shungite has a really remarkable structure within its carbon, where it has these occasional sort of buckyball pockets that can hold information. It's one of the reasons it's great at trapping things and clearing water and cleaning water, but also one of the reasons it's fantastic for adding to things like biochar, which also has these sort of buckyball pockets that make these wonderful homes for microbes. So, you know, definitely lean with the quartz. I do find that as nature powers house, it is phenomenal. Things like cobalt, Blue Quartz is also a wonderful thing to add. And there you're still using the powerhouse nature of quartz and its ability to store, amplify, and transmit information in the resonant way to water. But you also have the added element of cobalt, which of course nervous systems really require in that sort of B12 action in our bodies is also really beneficial.
Thank you very much. How might one utilize the crystal magnetite?
Oh, magnetite. Magnetite is super interesting. So I love magnetite just because I find it to be fascinating. In fact, there was just an article here recently that came out repeating something I had learned long ago, which was that gold can actually grow at the ends of magnetite. It's just very conductive in that way. So I do find this great relationship between magnetite and quartz, where magnetite sort of allows for this greater attraction of magnetic information, which quartz can then sort of encode. Marcel talked a lot about the metaphysical world of energy and consciousness really just being the other end of the spectrum from electromagnetism. You know, we have this electromagnetic world, EMF frequencies, and he said you can call it whatever you want if you want to give it a name. But one of the ways to think about it would be magnetoelectric energy being primarily consciousness, that sort of untangible, what we would consider metaphysical or greater than the physical world. So using magnetite as sort of a ether pump, to increase and pump more of this magnetoelectric energy and information, I find really effective in allowing for an increased information storage within the quartz.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Not to shift too much, again, Dr. Pollack hints at the use of sound in structuring water. What are your thoughts on the use of sound?
So I find, you know, we can see really easily that sound has a huge impact on structured water just through cymatics, right? And there's people doing that kind of work. We see it in our ancient and scriptural texts and approaches to creation and in things like God spoke the world into existence, that sound has an incredibly vibratory process that water can really, really resonate with and pick up. However, I do find that sound doesn't tend to create a lasting impression on the water. Unless that water is exposed to that sound for significant periods of time. We're talking many, many hours. For example, Luc Montagnier's experiment I described in the book, that was a hertz, a 7 hertz, which of course isn't an audible sound to us, but again, it is a sound. That was, I think, 18 hours for his experiment to work. So I do find that in order for sound to have a lasting effect on the structure of water, it kind of needs to create that resonant scalar wave that we would see through repeated chants. You know, this is why monks or spiritual people who are using chants to increase their consciousness level, you know, it's not about saying it one time. It's a repeated sound built up over time to impart that energy and information in sort of a scalar way where it can create a standing wave and last longer than the sound itself. So very effective and a wonderful way to impart structure to water. Short-term impact, unless that sound is used long enough to create a general standing wave within that water.
I'm really glad you brought it up, Luc Montagnier. Could you tell us who he is and what his research was?
Sure. Luc Montagnier, he is a scientist who is a Nobel laureate. He did an experiment using two test tubes, one containing DNA, the other containing pure water. And he exposed those tubes to a frequency hertz of 7 hertz for, again, I believe it was about 16 to 18 hours. And after that time, he evaluated the pure water in the vial and using an enzymatic reaction, discovered that the enzymes reacted to that pure water test tube as if there was the presence of DNA. And so the theory there, what that experiment then demonstrates is that using electromagnetic frequencies, information was able to transmit, that the structural information of the DNA was able to transmit to that test tube of pure water, so that that information was then encoded in the structure. Now, it's important to recognize the way that he tested that test tube was not through the actual presence of DNA. It was through an enzymatic reaction. So if you evaluate that test tube of water, it is still water, is still pure water. It does not have a DNA protein in it. However, the molecular organization of that water carries the information of that DNA. So enzymes added to the water will react as if they're in the presence of DNA. And that information transfer is really, really remarkable. He's showing a sort of teleportation of structural information traveling simply through electromagnetic frequencies, sort of piggybacking as a carrier wave on the 7 hertz band after a significant period of time where we've got enough standing wave for that information to transfer and hold. Now, he does not say in that experiment if he came back a week later if the enzyme would still react, or, you know, how long a period of time it might take for that water to lose that coded information, or not lose, restructure itself with enough new information to overwrite that coded DNA structure. That he doesn't get into, and those are the kind of questions that I like to consider after, you know, evaluating his work.
Yeah, everyone should know the name Luc Montagnier. He's an incredible man.
Isn't that phenomenal? Amazing.
And his recent comments on our, the COVID thing, but that's subject for another time. But in relation to your interest in that subject is the duration of what we call water memory. How long do you think water might hold a memory? And what might one do to increase that duration, or even wipe the memory?
Oh, great, great questions. So start with the first one. How long can water hold a memory? That question is just extremely subjective, because of course we really need to start with, well, what information is structured there in the first place? How complex is that? The structured water is a spectrum, right? The structure of water exists on a spectrum. So in order to really evaluate, well, how long is that memory going to hold? We really need to know, well, where is it on the spectrum? How structured is it? And then what kind of environment is that water in? Are we talking about a bottle of water again in that computer lab, or are we talking about a natural pool of water in a pristine environment, an untouched ecosystem, which unfortunately doesn't really exist anymore, but you know what I mean. So it's a very subjective question. Now, that being said, Marcel's work and the way that he was structuring water with a spiral movement, a vortex action of sorts, spinning around the Vogel crystals, and he found it needed a certain number of passes that needed to be in a certain direction, and it needed to be repeated a certain number of times in order to maximize its effectiveness. Now, he found that after passing his water through his system that number of times, that number of repetitions in that direction, that that structural integrity would build over the course of 3 hours and then begin to decline until it plateaued. After about 6 hours, it would plateau, still at a higher structure than it had started, but not as high as it had been when it had peaked. So that's fascinating, but of course that only relates to the activity that he was using to structure that. I wouldn't necessarily say that that holds true for every type of structural information. Sound, we discussed earlier, needs to be exposed for a certain amount of time in a certain sort of an environment, exclusionary of other sounds and influences. So again, I find that it's very subjective. Really depends on what we're doing. The more consciousness, the more mindful we are of that, the longer that structure holds and the more complex it is. I think that's very important. And then the more we can do to impart practices that can remain with the water. So, people will use magnets on the bottom of their glassware or underneath their planter pots, that kind of thing, to continually sort of impart, they'll add crystals to their soil to sort of continuously try to provide structural information so that as time goes on and that water information is being overwritten, that what it's being overwritten with still maintains or contributes to its structural integrity. So being mindful of those kinds of practices, I think, can really go a long way.
So in the few minutes that we have left, I have a couple more questions. What guidance would you have for those practicing agriculture? So, what indications would you give for the best use of water?
I think, for agriculture, some of the things that we're looking at, we're looking to increase growth rates, reduce pest and disease susceptibilities or increase resistance to improve the uptake of water. So less water usage, increasing its bioavailability and strengthening that relationship with the microbes in our soil, which are so, so important. In that regard, it's really important that our agricultural is mindful. Of course, in the biodynamic world, we're already very mindful of the effect that energy and movement and motion and practice can have. In our commercial farming world, we're still stuck in this dark age NPK attitude, which is just so destructive and damaging. So being mindful and imparting practices to vortex our water, to expose it to crystallographic pattern and information, the more complex, the better, really will increase dramatically the health of our farms, the health of our agriculture, its production levels, and how it contributes and participates in its ecosystem as a whole. We're also talking about nutrient profiles, right? Increasing the nutrient profiles of our food can happen simply through affecting and increasing the structure of our water. There's really no limit when it comes to agriculture, what we could do, I believe, through structured water science. It's just about fine-tuning, finding what works, implementing those practices, really developing systems that we can share.
And Carly,
yeah.
What is something you'd like to speak more about, but you're hesitant because you don't think people are ready?
Unfortunately, I think there's a lot people aren't ready for. One of the things I'm hesitant to talk about, or I wish was talked about more. Well, yeah, this is such a fabulous question, Will. I'm really glad you asked that. If there's one thing I could talk about more, it would be bringing our attention to the state of our infrastructure and our tap water across America. I find that there are too many people who will spend their entire life without ever drinking a cup of just clean quality water. And in our day and age, in our technology, in our advanced society, we're the richest nation in the world, and people are forced to drink a toxic soup, a plethora of carcinogens, to an extent that we're just not even aware of. We just, as a whole society, has no idea what they're drinking. It looks clear. And so it looks like water. It must be like water. But that's not true. It's simply not true. So if there's one thing I could talk more about, it would be that. My hesitancy is that it's very scary, and there's not a lot of solutions. So it's very hard to tell someone, you are drinking cancer, carcinogens, cancer-causing liquid that your government and your infrastructure has determined the risk level is acceptable. The 5 in 100,000 that will get uterine cancer from that contaminant in that water is acceptable. It's acceptable. And I find it unacceptable. I really feel that everyone should have access to clean, quality water, and very few of us do. And it's hard for me to tell people that without, and then having to follow up with, well, the only way is to really invest finances and financial resources that you might not have, because it is so contaminated. It really takes that much work to clean it and treat it and condition it in a way where it's life supportive. So that's something I really want to change.
Dr. Newday, again, thank you for joining us. You can find Dr. Newday at watercodes.com, and you can find the Biodynamic Guild at biodynamicguild.org.